This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Former British Prime Minister Harold Wilson spoke for many when he said that he started to read Das Kapital and gave up on page two. Karl Marx's masterwork is forbiddingly long and dauntingly dense, a book cited more often than read, but unquestionably one of the more influential books in history. Known as the father of communism, the German philosopher and political economist needed more than 20 years to finish his critique of industrial capitalism, partly because he kept getting distracted by other projects, like learning Russian or figuring out how electricity works. And while we think of his epic tome as a treatise on economics, Marx biographer Francis Wheen argues you could also consider it a comedy, a tragedy, or a gothic horror story with as much satire as dialectic. Das Kapital is the latest in a series from the Atlantic Monthly Press we featured on books that changed the world. Francis Wheen joins us in just a moment. Later in the program, lessons from the life and the murder of pro football star Sean Taylor. But first, Francis Wheen's biography of Das Kapital. If you've always wondered what Marx intended or what he meant or why he's relevant after the collapse of communism, our number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogthenation. Francis Wheen joins us from BBC Studios in London. Thanks very much for coming in.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm honoured to think that you're devoting this time to Karl Marx, a man who was written off some years ago as being no longer of any interest to anyone. It's rather amazing, and certainly confirms my suspicion that perhaps there may be one or two things still worth considering and reading and thinking about in his work.
Well, apparently, that moment when everybody decided, whew, there's a big fat book we don't have to read anymore, that was the moment when you got interested in Karl Marx.
Absolutely, yes, yes. Well, I think partly just an instinctive thing. I always like to stick up for the underdog and the unfashionable cause. And when I wrote my biography of Karl Marx back in the 90s, it seemed to me that this was the most unpopular, unfashionable subject one could possibly choose to write about, because at the end of the Cold War, there was this idea put about, I mean, rather like Francis Fukuyama's End of History, that we'd now reached the end of history and that Karl Marx was dead and buried, as you said, in the rubble of the Berlin Wall, and no one need ever think about him again. And it seemed to me that actually he'd been buried long before that, flattened by all those dreadful Stalinist era icons where, you know, he was part of the Holy Trinity with Marx as a sort of godlike figure with a big white beard, and then Lenin as John the Baptist and Stalin as the Redeemer or the Messiah. He'd been buried for most of the 20th century by his self-styled disciples. And actually it seemed to me the end of the Cold War and the breakup of 20th century style Marxism was a very good moment to dig him out and actually hear what he had to say, what he thought and read and did, rather than what was claimed on his behalf by various spokespersons who might not necessarily have been very reliable on the subject.
In fact, you write that Karl Marx had always been studied much more carefully and closely in the enemy camp in the West than he ever was in the communist camp.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, he was used in the communist camp. But, I mean, the very fact that where it all started in 1917 was in Russia, the Russian Revolution with Lenin and co, slightly shows how little they'd read or understood him, because one of Marx's recurring themes was that revolution, a proletarian revolution, as he put it, could only really break out once you'd reached an advanced stage of bourgeois industrial capitalism. And therefore, according to that theory, if it was going to start anywhere, it would be somewhere like Britain, the home of the Industrial Revolution, rather than in a sort of feudal peasant society like Russia. And so in order to get round this problem, the Russian revolutionaries had to do an awful lot of nimble footwork and ignoring large parts of what he'd said and actually distorting him in the most extraordinary way. I mean, Lenin was the first offender, but there were many thereafter. Basically creating a new sort of elite vanguard class of revolutionary intellectuals, which was absolutely against the whole nature of what Marx was saying, that the revolution, if there is to be one, must arise from the masses, from the people, from the workers, rather than from a handful of people like Lenin. So from the outset, it was taking a different direction, and certainly by the time the Gulag was created, I mean, Marx's favourite motto was De omnibus dubitandum. Everything must be questioned. Don't take anything for granted. Question everything, challenge everything, criticise everything, which I don't think was somehow the motto of Stalinist Russia. If he'd gone around saying De omnibus dubitandum, he would have been straight in the Labour camp.
Or any of the other countries that claim to be Marxist, as you describe it, from Albania to Zimbabwe.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the whole essence of Marxism, I mean, people sometimes say to me, would you call yourself a Marxist? And I say, certainly not, because apart from anything else, it's meaningless. I mean, the word has been used in so many different 57 varieties that, you know, if it covers everyone from Fidel Castro to Enver Hoxha to Kim Il-sung to goodness knows who, to various French theoreticians and academics, then it doesn't really mean very much. But insofar as Marxism means anything, I mean, in the spirit of Marx himself, it is a process, it's a method, a way of arguing, a way of looking at the world, of trying to understand the world, of criticising, of arguing. It's a continuing engagement. It's not sort of Ten Commandments written on tablets of stone, but unfortunately, that's exactly what it became.
We want to get listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. But I did want to ask you one question. And we think of Marx's work. Well, he has a lot of predictions in his work. Is the genius of his work rather more descriptive of his analysis of capitalism?
Yes, I think that would be a fair comment, actually. As a prophet, as a prophet, sometimes he's remarkable. But there is a slight problem, which is the tension between, if you like, his intellect and his will. The famous phrase of another 20th century Marxist, Antonio Gramsci, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. Or if you want to put it in plain English, be prepared for the worst, but hope for the best. But it's a bit more complex than that. And Marx, intellectually, I mean, as a student of capitalism and an analyst of it, absolutely understood what an extraordinarily powerful system it was. I mean, in the Communist Manifesto, the pamphlet he wrote back in 1848, he described it as having surpassed wonders far greater than, you know, the Egyptian pyramids or any other ancient wonders of the world, having torn aside all sorts of old feudal, sentimental, social relations, absolutely ruthless and pitiless and remarkable. I mean, technologically remarkable and remarkable in so many ways. So he was, you know, he gave capitalism its due, and given the strength of that system, which he described very powerfully, he sort of knew that it wouldn't just keel over and die. On the other hand, he hoped it would, and so there is a slight conflict in his work when he'll give a long... I mean, actually, in Das Kapital, nobody ever seems to notice this, probably because they don't get beyond page two, but at the very end of volume two, the last chapter of volume two, he actually gives a sort of schematic presentation, an economic model of a capitalist system which grows steadily and, in theory, can carry on indefinitely. But I think that's... I mean, it is slightly buried right at the end of volume two, because although he can see that's a possibility, he doesn't quite like to admit it. So there's rhetoric. I mean, from time to time, he comes out with his blood-curdling rhetoric about it creating its own grave diggers and all the rest of it.
Vampires, yes.
And there's an awful lot about vampires and horror stories and ghosts and phantoms and things. And quite right, too, actually, because the other part of Das Kapital, I mean, it's a very strange book. It's got so many different styles. But part of it is a kind of Dickensian portrait of mid-19th century capitalism, of horrific conditions in the factories with nine-year-old children working 13 hours a day and all this sort of thing. So you can see why it's a horror story and why he talks about vampires. But he does... I think also he does notice... this is why... One of the reasons why I think he is still worth reading and thinking about. He does notice, earlier than most champions of capitalism, that there is an inherent instability in the system. That
boom and bust, yeah.
It's boom and bust. I mean, the rhythm of it is boom and bust, like breathing in and breathing out, that it has to do that to continue and to grow, and that it's full of contradictions. You know, obviously, capitalism depends on competition, in theory, and so competition is at the heart of it. But, of course, actually, if you get into the system and you want to be a successful capitalist, you do your utmost to destroy the competition. And so there is this, the mid-20th century economist, a free market economist, great hero to entrepreneurs, Joseph Schumpeter, coined the phrase creative destruction to describe how capitalism works. He says it's a system of creative destruction. And actually, when he wrote about that, he gave due tribute to Marx, said Marx was the first person to notice that it's creative and utterly destructive simultaneously, and that its creativity depends on this constant revolution, constantly destroying and creating anew, not just destroying your competitors, but destroying the methods that have been used in the past for making these products, new technology, new markets, breaking open all sorts of things, creating a global market, and also in the course of that, destroying all sorts of traditions and social relations. It's not just economic, it's about people's lives, the habits of their work and their play. All those get torn apart in order to create the new market.
Let's get a caller in, 800-989-8255. We'll begin with Donald. Donald with us from, where is that, Bernie in Texas?
Yeah, yes, sir, Bernie in Texas.
Go ahead, please.
Hi, I majored in the evolution of economic analysis in the early 70s, and I actually labored through a lot of Das Kapital. A side issue, I've recently turned my own political perspective on its head as I read a biography of John Kenneth Galbraith in liberal economics. And have you encountered any reaction lately, given the new, I guess, polarization of politics in this country, people becoming more cynical about the market economy, quote unquote. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, Donald, thank you.
Well, it is, at the same time as Marx was supposedly being buried around about 1990, the end of history and the triumph of capitalism, and the market, I mean, market fundamentalism really coming into its own, this new gospel, there is no alternative. Within a very few years of that, I think about 1998, that George Soros, of all people, the billionaire speculator, wrote a book called The Crisis of Global Capitalism. And I remember about the same time, after we'd had the Asian financial crisis and then the Russian meltdown, there was a piece in the Financial Times in London headed Das Kapital Revisited. And only a few years earlier, we'd been told the market is supreme. I mean, it was a godlike status given to it. It was sort of invisible but omniscient and all the rest of it. And yet within a very few years, there were all these crises erupting all over the place. And even the beneficiaries of the system, the people who understood and played the system, like George Soros, were beginning to sound the alarm and say, this is getting out of control. We've created a monster here. If we're not careful, it's going to destroy itself and us at the same time. And it's amazing to me how quickly that happened. The market triumphalism began to be a bit tempered and muted by these warnings. I mean, I think Bill Gates has occasionally said vaguely similar things, not quite as apocalyptic as George Soros, but there has been this this slight retreat from it and a feeling that perhaps the market alone, absolutely unregulated and left to its own devices, may not be the best way to ensure stability and prosperity for all and forever.
We're talking about Francis Wien's biography of Das Kapital, part of our series on books that changed the world. More on the book and on the relevance of Karl Marx himself in a moment. And we'll take more of your calls, of course, 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about Karl Marx and what's been called his masterpiece, Das Kapital. It's part of our series on books that changed the world. You can read about Marx's childhood and find the rest of our series at our website, npr.org/talk. We got this email from Cheryl, who writes, our local broadcaster read the promo for this segment as one of the books that changed the world series. So I wondered, did Karl Marx change the playoff between the two top baseball teams in the United States? Funny how one hears things. Francis Wien wrote the biography of Marx's Das Kapital in addition to a biography of Marx himself. He's with us today from a BBC studio in London. If you'd like to write us email, that's talk@npr.org. And our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And you can also go to our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. Let's get another caller on the line. Jonathan joins us. Jonathan calling from Iowa City.
Hi. I appreciate this topic and your guest. I think it's an unfortunate irony that we live in an age, especially in the United States, where saying the word Marx is almost like a dirty word because of its link to communism. I think from my point of view, one of the things that Marx was trying to do was make a link between academia and philosophy and the real world and activism, which is sort of a noble goal for many people in academia. Unfortunately, because he successfully did that and became associated with a political party, the history of that political party and all of the things that unfolded in history after that have become now retroactively applied to Marx, which is really unfortunate, because if it hadn't been for that, I think people might appreciate Marx a lot more as a philosopher and a historian for everything that he contributed, from historical materialism to dialecticism.
I think that's very true. Part of the problem also is that he covers so many different disciplines. I mean, he was a philosopher, but he was also dealing with history, with geography, with economics, politics, literature, indeed. I mean, apart from anything else, Das Kapital, he set out to create a work of art. He kept referring to it as a work of art. It was, as I said earlier, a bit like a Gothic novel or something like that, or Dante's Inferno, indeed. And part of the problem is he falls between disciplines. I mean, I've noticed that schools in England occasionally, sort of 18-year-olds, I'll ask them, do you do Marx if you're doing economics A-level? And they say, no, I asked my teacher. And he said, no, no, ask in philosophy. And you ask in philosophy. He said, no, I think he's covered by history, probably. and he ends up not being read by any of them.
I think it would do more people a service if we took Marx a bit more seriously and didn't dismiss him as some communist trash or something.
As a failure. I mean, that's the perception is that he came up with this idea, was tried, and it failed.
Well, it wasn't tried, though. I mean, and also the idea, I mean, as I said, the idea was not so much a prescriptive idea. I mean, you said earlier the difference between his description and his prescription. I mean, his vision of a communist society, if you want to call it that, is fairly sketchy, and he doesn't really go into much detail about it. What he mainly focuses on is the contradictions and the inherent instabilities in the existing system that he's living in, industrial capitalism. And on that, he's absolutely matchless, I think. And funnily enough, about 10 years ago, there was a piece in The New Yorker all about Karl Marx saying he was the next big thinker, which was very good news for me because I was just writing my biography at the time. And it quoted a Wall Street banker. The bloke who wrote the piece from The New Yorker was holidaying with a friend of his from Wall Street and saw that they had Marx books on the bedside table. He said, you don't read Karl Marx. He said, oh, yes, we all read him on Wall Street. No one understood capitalism better. And I thought, well, you know, it's all very well for Wall Street bankers to read him, but why should they have all the fun? Why can't the rest of us give him a go and learn something as well?
Marx himself was a mass of contradictions. You describe him as a curious hybrid of ferocious self-confidence and anguished self-doubt. Part of the reason it took him so long to finish this book?
Yes, yes. Well, it was hopeless trying to get him to finish anything. I mean, part of his problem was that what he was trying to write about was so huge and all-embracing. I mean, I know the problem myself trying to write books. You can't bear to leave anything out, and one line of inquiry leads to another. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, if you Google things on the internet, you go to some website and then there's an interesting link there. So you then click on that and that leads to something else that looks rather promising. So you click on that and an hour later you've gone down this chain of consequences and you're miles from where you started, but you haven't actually got any further in a certain sense.
And he also wrote the book, most of it, in London, in the British Library, in conditions of just horrible poverty.
Yes, yes. Well, that was, I mean, the other thing, the passion in his work definitely comes from a sense of resentment about his own conditions that he's living there. I mean, for a long time in London, he was living in two small rooms in Soho with a large family, and they had no money at all. And they were bailed out by his friend Frederick Engels, who was a successful industrialist in Manchester. Half the time, I mean, Prussian spies used to wait outside his apartment, sent over by the King of Prussia to spy on him, and they would report back. You can read their reports saying, we don't understand it. He hasn't come out for 3 days now. What is he plotting in there? And you then read Marx's letters to Engels for the same 3 days saying, I can't leave the apartment because my trousers are at the pawn shop. They're in hock. And so I have no clothes to wear until I can raise some money and send my wife out to the pawn shop to get some clothes for me to wear. So that was the scale of the thing. I mean, he could barely afford a loaf of bread half the time.
Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Mary. Mary from Portland, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
I'm working on a thesis about sort of capitalism and activism against it. And I have a question for Mr. Wien. If revolution will happen when a certain point has been reached, I sort of see that we are reaching that point as far as corporations controlling our economy and sort of hurting the environment, and we are reaching a point where at first the disenfranchised were against it, and now the intelligentsia, Al Gore and Robert Baer and those type of people are joining in saying that capitalism is unsustainable. Do you see the end of capitalism coming soon?
I think it would be rash to see the end of capitalism coming soon, and perhaps one should heed the lesson of Marx, who every time there was a financial crisis, I mean, particularly in the 1860s, right, but there was succession of financial crises, and every time he would lick his lips and rub his hands and say, this must be it, this is the big one, it's all going to come crashing down. and then it didn't. And we've been through a good many crises and recessions since then. And it does have a remarkable resilience, the system, which, as I say, I mean, in parts of his work he acknowledges. So I think it would be a mistake to assume that this really is it. But on the other hand, there's no doubt that all the instability he described is as much in evidence today as it ever was. I mean, I mentioned George Soros earlier in his book about the crisis of global capitalism. He keeps saying that the system left to itself shows no tendency towards equilibrium. I mean, there's a lot of talk about equilibrium in the market economy, but actually there is no sign of a tendency towards that without some sort of restraining influences, which, of course, is why someone mentioned Galbraith earlier, the great Keynesian. I mean, why Keynesianism came in the 20th century after the 20s and 30s and all the disasters then. It was clear that actually the system was on the brink of collapse, unless there could be some sort of New Deal, some sort of involvement in the market to temper its excesses, its sort of wild speculative manias and things like that, particularly after the Wall Street crash and the Hungry 30s and all the rest of it. And so for much of the 20th century, it was restrained and tempered. But then by about 1980 or so, the new era of market fundamentalism came in with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and the rest of it. And I think we're now seeing the consequences of that and perhaps tiptoeing back towards some form of sort of latter-day Keynesianism almost. I think the ghost of Galbraith would be rather amused to see what's happening.
Mary, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here's an email we got from Joel in Salisbury, Maryland. I believe Marx predicted the development of capitalism would bring about an ever-increasing inequality, concentrating more and more wealth in fewer hands. Does not the explosive growth in the gap between the rich and the rest of us over the past 20 years or so seem to validate that observation? A sliver at the top of the ladder now owns a percentage of all the wealth, twice that of 1980.
Absolutely, yes, yes. I think he's utterly vindicated in that, as in many other things. I mean, as in his description of the pattern of boom and bust and recession and growth. And at the heart of Das Kapital is an argument that capitalism depends on exploitation. I mean, if you had to summarize it in a sentence, it's very hard to, because it's a vast work. But that is at the heart of it, the recurring theme. It's about exploitation and alienation, if you like, as well. I mean, there are many other sub-themes. And I think that's as true today as it ever is. I mean, you only have to look at the various places around the world where, I don't know, where your trainers are made or your T-shirts are made or the call centres that ring you up trying to sell you things to see that exploitation is still at the heart of it and will continue to be so because, of course, that is what drives it.
Let's get Mark on the line. Mark with us from South Bend in Indiana.
Hi, Neil. Thank you for taking my call. It was a very interesting discussion today. I really appreciate it. I was listening to it driving home, and I was thinking about my experience when I taught Marx to undergraduates at a college I teach at. And one of the things I've tried to stress with them, for whom Marx is a sort of relic of the sort of past in some ways, is that there's often in the United States been a real emphasis, or at least I guess a focus on, am I a Marxist or not when I read this? Somewhat like with feminism, too, I suppose, but Marx especially, if I read this, I agree with it, does that make me a Marxist? And one of the things I think that creates some resistance, and I try to encourage students to read it with a sense of, does this help you make sense of the world that you live in today or not? And maybe part of it does and part of it doesn't, and you don't have to decide whether you're a Marxist or not based on that. You can just decide, does this help us make sense of capitalism, which is, of course, what Marx was writing about. And a couple of things I found particularly that students connected with was one Marxist perception of how radical capitalism was in terms of changing things and how how irrelevant tradition and things like religion were. If they got in the way of capitalism growing, capitalism was basically for, you know, removing them. And so why is religion so sort of made fun of on television, on commercials? Because it sells things. And likewise, the focus on commodification of so many things, including today lifestyles, revolution, and the like. Students can often find those things very interesting, and Marx gives them something to think about, even if they are not necessarily going to become a socialist.
Yes, I mean, commodification and commodities, actually the very first chapter of Volume 1 is on commodities, and it was probably a mistake in many ways because it's the most abstract and difficult chapter of that whole volume. And Engels, Marx's friend, actually complained when he saw the manuscript. He said, how could you put this right at the front? No one will get any further in the book. And Marx, rather grumpily, said, well, I assume a reader who's prepared to make some effort. And unfortunately, a lot of readers didn't make the effort and didn't get any further. But it is a sort of abstract meditation, almost, on what is a commodity. And he introduces this idea of commodity fetishism, as he puts it. It goes way beyond conventional economics, classical economics. It's almost a work of philosophy or spiritual meditation, as I say. And he talks about the fetishism of commodities, and you only have to look at the queues around the block to buy an iPhone and the sort of the talismanic quality of every new commodity that comes on the market to see that pure economics doesn't necessarily account fully for the extraordinary appeal these things have and the value they acquire. I mean, it's way beyond mere the labour theory of value, which he also writes about. There is also this element of magic in it, which he describes, I think, far more vividly. Well, nobody had really described it like that before, because classical economists didn't really go in for that sort of philosophy or the religious element of it. I mean, ascribing fetishistic qualities, rather like a religious icon or the bones of a saint or something. But, I mean, it is like that. And every time a commodity comes on the market, I think of old Marx and think he would have enjoyed the iPhone.
Mark, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We're talking with Francis Wien about his new biography of Das Kapital. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get Elizabeth on the line with us from Los Angeles.
Hey, how are you? I actually took a course where we covered Hegel first, then Kierkegaard, and finally Marx. And I was wondering if you could talk at all about what it was exactly that he rejected in Hegel. I mean, I don't want you to go too far back.
Oh, please don't.
Excuse me?
I was saying, please don't go too far.
No. But one thing, I mean, I got the feeling from him that he was this deeply spiritual person, and I wasn't exactly sure why I got that feeling. I don't think he's usually painted like that, but I got the feeling that he really wanted to take a closer look at our values as values that don't come from the sky or from God, from us. You know, he said they were usually the values of the ruling class. And
he does write a lot about the soul, doesn't he, Francis Wien?
Yes, he does. I mean, he was not a spiritual person in the sense of being religious, but he was fascinated by religion. I mean, he started, in a sense, as a theologian. I mean, his whole life was a succession of dialectical exchanges, if you want to put it that way. So he started by criticising religion. That then led him into philosophy, and after his argument with the philosophers, including Hegel, he then moved on to political economy and so forth, but incorporated all these things into his later work. And so religion does loom large, and he certainly knew a lot about it. I mean, he had a rather interesting religious background himself, coming from a Jewish long line of rabbis, among other things.
Heard he was originally a poet, or he wanted to be a poet.
He wrote a novel.
Yes, he did write poetry in his youth, and he also wrote a novel which was not published, but he wanted to be a poet, and he always revered poets, which is why when as he put it, as he was a student, the realm of poetry collapsed before him and he realised he couldn't be a poet. For the rest of his life, he adored poets, and he was a friend, for example, of Heinrich Heine, the great German poet, and he made allowances for him that he wouldn't make for political opponents or other people who disagreed with him. And as he used to say to his children, poets are strange fish and they must be allowed to go their own ways. They're a sort of special breed. And he was slightly in awe of poets. And if you read any of his work, especially Das Kapital, it's full of poetry. As I say, from Dante to Goethe to Heine, Shakespeare, they're all in there. And it is a work of literature as much as a work of economics or anything else.
Elizabeth, thanks very much.
Great, thank you so much.
Bye-bye. And let me just, in way of conclusion, ask you about one of his favorite pieces of literature, a work that you refer to several times in your biography of Das Kapital, and that's Frankenstein.
Yes. Well, it's actually obvious when you think about it that he's writing about a monster created by humans that then comes to life violently and starts menacing its own creator. And this is a very good analogy for how he looks at commodities. There are these inanimate objects which human beings create, but in the process of creating the commodities, the human beings, the workers in the factories, are reduced to the level of machines, of inanimate objects, while the commodities assume this extraordinary vigour and life and indeed menace and become far more lively than the supposedly human people who've created them, who are reduced to the status of objects. And so you can see why, again and again, he came back to the Frankenstein image that we have created our own monster.
I think he also liked the image of the torches and the pitchforks going after it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He liked a bit of blood-curdling stuff. I mean, the vampires you mentioned earlier, it's blood and gore. Maybe someday someone will make an epic movie based on Das Kapital, and it'll be very much for only 18-year-olds and above, I think.
Francis Wien, thanks very much for being with us today. Francis Wien's new book is a biography of Das Kapital. It's part of the series published by the Atlantic Monthly Press on books that changed the world. And Francis Wien joined us today from BBC Studios in London. Coming up, the search for lessons in the life and the murder of NFL star Sean Taylor. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.